This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Weeknights at 11 for great national programming right here on commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Belinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
And Elisar Saliba.
Tonight's show, Jennifer's going to talk to...
Well, I have with us tonight Adina Gray, as well as Estelle Stewart, both members of the Black Dems, but I also have other positions in the community. And we're going to be talking about AIDS in the Black community as well as in our own community, and what can be done and how we can work together and combine our communities in a coalition basis to make the most of it and get the word out.
Also, in the first hour, we're going to be playing News Wrap from This Way Out and the other items from This Way Out. In the second hour, we have a powerful speech by Leslie Feinberg, the author of Stone Bitch Blues and Transgendered Warriors, talks about the many issues of matrial effects on... boy, I should have read this. This is a tongue twister.
It is tough.
Yes. Talking about gender role, feminism, and more. Not to be missed. And if Deborah Bell wrote this, that's true. It's not to be missed.
No.
Of course, we're heading up to the holiday season for a lot of people. And
yes.
The cold weather, although here in the studio, it's probably 108 degrees.
Well, it warmed up a little bit today.
A lot of parties going on, I know. But they're mostly probably private parties, not public parties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock is over Pacifica. Over on Pacific Street, and that's the I've had a blonde moment that we're I can't remember.
Are they going to light a tree or something?
No. It's the fact that one of the foundations is donating money to the caucus as well as to the Unity Committee and a number of other very worthwhile community efforts. And before the show's over, I'll have that information.
Okay, I don't remember reading about that, yeah. But that's good. And, there's been a lot of other parties. I know the tree was going up over Mary's when they light that. I don't know, to be honest with you.
Oh, well. Yeah.
I was there one year when they lit it when it was raining like crazy, and we thought the whole thing was going to just... anyway, so all that's going on in the next couple weeks, next week and the week following, JD's doing a special on Christmas music, queer Christmas music, of course.
Yes, that's going to be good. You need to all listen to that. Also, anybody that's interested, All My Children, a week ago today, started a transgendered character. And I thought it was very interesting. It's been fairly, from my own personal perspective, I thought it was interesting. Only thing about it, I didn't like the character to begin with, and now I have to sort of like him for a reason.
And speaking of that, A&E tonight is going to be running a show, I think it's a movie called A Wedding Planner.
Yes.
With John Stamos. I think that starts at...
The Wedding Wars is the name of
you're
it.
Right.
I am,
you're right.
I am, got my VHS set so I can watch it later on tonight or tomorrow.
So, yes, and I'm sure if it's, you don't see it tonight, it'll be repeated a couple of times.
Well, I liked it in the promo. It said, what would the world do if all the gays went on strike?
It's actually, it's on right now. It's because it says here 9 o'clock, so I'm sure that's Eastern time.
It started 8 o'clock our time.
So yes, and I'm sure it will be repeated if you don't see it.
Yes, it's repeated at 10.
So, with all of that, let's listen to News Wrap from This Way Out.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Charles Hall.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending December 9th, 2006.
Yay, school, 123. Nays, contre, 175.
I declare the motion defeated.
More than 3 years after some of the country's provincial courts set in motion federal legislation to end discrimination against same-gender couples, Canada's gays and lesbians can finally rest easy. The country's House of Commons voted 175 to 123 on December 7th to reject a proposal by the minority Conservative Party government to revisit the contentious issue. The margin was greater than those on either side had expected, and larger than the 2005 vote in Parliament that established marriage equality. What appears to be the final nail in the coffin for opponents left LGBT rights advocates celebrating, and anti-queer groups accusing the minority Conservative government of betrayal. "We made a promise to have a free vote on this issue," said Prime Minister Stephen Harper, referring to his successful election campaign, "and we kept that promise." Much to the displeasure of right-wing groups still fighting what they acknowledge was a losing battle, Harper called the vote decisive, saying, "I don't see reopening this question in the future." Among those voting against the motion were five members of Harper's own cabinet.
About 12,400 marriage licenses have been issued to same-gender couples in Canada since the province of Ontario became the first to legalize them in June 2003, according to Canadians for Equal Marriage. "With each passing month, more and more same-sex couples are getting married," said its national coordinator, Laurie Aaron. "In fact, gay and lesbian couples have been heading to the altar in Canada in unprecedented numbers, according to new statistics released this week. From the beginning of June through October, there was a jump of 23% in the number of same-gender couples obtaining marriage licenses. In Ontario, where over 6,500 same-gender couples have now wed, there was a 17% increase, and Quebec enjoyed a 35% increase during the same 5 months. But the biggest jump was in the country's most conservative province, Alberta, where the numbers increased by 40%.
Wedding fever has also swept the United Kingdom. The Office for National Statistics revealed this week that 15,672 civil partnerships have been contracted since December 2005, when they first became legal in the UK, through September 2006. While not calling it marriage, the Civil Partnership Act gives same-gender couples virtually the same rights as their heterosexually wed counterparts. 14,084 civil partnership ceremonies were held during the period in England, with London hosting about 25% of them. There were 942 in Scotland, 109 in Northern Ireland, and 537 in Wales. It was assumed there would be in the region of between 11,000 and 22,000 civil partnerships by the year 2010, a government spokesperson told reporters. So we are already past the midway point of that estimation in just 9 months of the Civil Partnership Act coming into force.
Italy's Senate this week passed a motion calling on the government of Prime Minister Romano Prodi to offer legislation creating civil unions for gay and lesbian couples by the end of January. The motion cited the growing debate within politics and public opinion concerning common law unions and the rights and duties stemming from them. The move came on the heels of a vote earlier in the week in the northern city of Padua to create a domestic partner registry for same-gender and unmarried heterosexual couples, the first such action in any Italian municipality. The campaign platform of Prodi's leftist coalition last year included granting rights to same-gender couples. His diverse coalition ranges from communists who favor full marriage equality to Catholic-affiliated politicians who oppose any rights for gay and lesbian partners. Prodi himself opposes marriage and prefers civil unions. His government has reportedly been working on a bill that would be similar to Britain's civil partnership law that grants all the rights of marriage but not the name. But a draft bill has not yet been completed. Prodi's office issued a statement approving the January 31st deadline, however, saying the Senate vote represents a fundamental step forward. Pope Benedict XVI warned Prodi's government this week that the Vatican will use all of its power to thwart any move to legally recognize same-gender couples. Speaking at yet another Vatican conference on marriage and the family, Benedict yet again condemned same-gender unions, insisting that a marriage must be a union between a man and a woman and must be open to procreation.
South Australia's parliament caught up with the rest of that country's states and territories by passing a domestic partnership bill this week. The vote was an overwhelming 16-3. It will grant South Australia's same-gender couples many of the same rights as heterosexually married couples. Queer activists are confident that Governor Marjorie Jackson Nelson will sign the bill into law before the end of the year. South Australia's lobby for the rights of same-gender couples, Let's Get Equal, was relieved by the bill's passage after two previous attempts ended in failure, but said it was only the beginning of the journey toward full equality. Of course, there are still areas of the law where we aren't equal, the group said on its website, for example, with regard to adoption rights and reproductive rights, but it's a start.
A legislative committee in the U.S. state of New Jersey this week approved by a 4-2 vote a bill that would create civil unions, giving same-gender couples rights equivalent to heterosexual marriage, but refusing to call them that. An October state Supreme Court ruling ordered marriage equality for lesbian and gay couples, but left it to lawmakers to decide what to call such unions. According to a Reuters report, the New Jersey Assembly Judiciary Committee heard sometimes emotional testimony from all sides during a four-hour-long hearing. Steve McIntyre said he's been with his partner for 20 years and they want to be legally married. He's not my roommate. He's not my partner. He's my husband, he told the panel. Stephen Goldstein, the chair of Garden State Equality, said the civil unions bill offers nothing that New Jersey gay and lesbian couples don't already have under the state's domestic partner law. He said the legislation is not even as comprehensive as Vermont's civil unions law, and that the 60 pages of paper used to print this bill is an assault on the trees killed. Even by the standards of a civil unions bill, it's still putrid. He accused lawmakers of trying to rush the bill through, even as equality advocates were mounting a major campaign across the state to generate support for full marriage rights.
The bill was also introduced in the New Jersey legislature this week to grant full marriage equality to gay and lesbian couples. Even though that measure appears to be going nowhere, its sponsor came out in the process. Democratic New Jersey Assemblyman Reed Guskiora, who becomes the first openly gay member of the New Jersey legislature, told a TV news show that, I've just never made an issue of it. If someone asks me, I tell them. No one ever asked me publicly before. He believes that his constituents won't care that he's gay. At least I hope so, he said. New Jersey is a lot more tolerant than other states. But while a survey by the Quinnipiac University Polling Institute in Hamden, Connecticut, reported this week that 60% of New Jersey voters support a law allowing civil unions, half are against calling them marriage. According to most reports, the civil unions bill is expected to be approved in both houses of the state legislature by the end of the year.
And finally, the lesbian daughter of U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney is pregnant. Mary Cheney and her partner of 15 years, Heather Poe, are ecstatic about the baby, due in May or June, a source close to the couple told the Washington Post. Details about the conception have not been disclosed. The couple moved from Colorado to Virginia a year ago to be closer to Cheney's family. In November, Virginia voters passed a state constitutional amendment banning same-gender marriages and civil unions. State law is unclear on whether Poe will have any parental rights there.
A vice presidential spokesperson told reporters that Dick and Lynn Cheney are looking forward with eager anticipation to the arrival of their sixth grandchild. But the news has outraged right-wing conservative groups, for whom the vice president has generally been a poster boy. Kerry Gordon Earle, a spokesperson for Focus on the Family, told reporters that just because it's possible to conceive a child outside the relationship of a married mother and father doesn't mean it's best for the child. Love cannot replace a mom or a dad. But Executive Director Jeff Lutz of SoulForce, an ecumenical LGBT advocacy group, said, "We find it unconscionable that Focus on the Family has exploited this good news in order to once again ignore the social science research on same-sex parent families." The American Association of Marriage and Family Therapy, American Psychological Association, and American Academy of Pediatrics have each issued statements in support of adoption rights and legal protections for same-gender parents and their children. As far back as 2001, sociologists Judith Stacy and Timothy Biblars published a comprehensive review of the research on lesbian and gay parenting in the American Sociological Review. In an interview, Dr. Stacy concluded that there is not a single respectable social scientist conducting and publishing research in this area today who claims that gay and lesbian parents harm children. Stacey later asserted that children of same-gender parents may, in fact, have an advantage by some measures because of selection factors. It's because these are wanted children, she said. When you're looking at heterosexual parenting, you have a lot of accidental pregnancies.
That's News Wrap for the week ending December 9th, 2006. Written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK, Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Charles Hall.
That was Brittany Lane with Cowboy Hat from Radiator.
This is Queer Voices.
And
This is Jennifer Renee, and we have with us tonight Dina Gray, who is with the city on housing and community development, as well as manager of HOPWA, H-O-P-W-A. I'm going to have to ask you what that means in a moment. And Estelle Stewart, who is chief of staff for Sue Lovell. And tonight we're going to talk about, all of us happen to be members of Black Dems.
That's right.
And that's one of the reasons why we're here. All these other things are important because I'm president of the GLBT Political Caucus. But tonight we're going to talk about something that's important to all of us.
Absolutely.
And that is AIDS in both our community but also the Black community.
Sounds good.
So first tell us what HOPWA.
Yeah.
Yes. That's H-O-P-W-A.
H-O-P-W-A. It stands for Housing Opportunities for People with AIDS.
All right. That's what I think.
Yeah.
Good, good. Talk to me. Tell what is it that the Black community isn't hearing out there that they need to hear about AIDS? I'm looking at you, Estelle.
I don't think it's so much that they're not hearing the message. I think sometimes we're in denial about the reality of the current situation. It's a crisis, especially in Harris County and Houston. We're almost at a crisis level.
What sort of percentages are we talking about? When you say crisis, now I know some of that information, but the audience may not know. As far as the percentage of HIV positive and exposed.
Well, if I could, in Houston, the rate of infection is synonymous across the country. I mean, we're an urban city, but we see the same kind of rates that you would see in a Chicago, Philadelphia, Miami. And one of the statistics that to me is most alarming is the fact that 75% of all women who are HIV positive today are African American women. That in itself is startling, and that makes me as an African American woman, peeved, number one. But then on top of it, it makes you really want to kind of focus in on and see what's going on with a particular population, that this epidemic can be so disparagingly large from either the white community or even the male community. Women are infected at a rate twice as high as men, and young people are rising. At 13 to 19, you're seeing a huge surge in not only HIV, but other sexually transmitted diseases. So I agree with Estelle. I think that there's a stigma, and there's still the denial there, but I think the information, we need to start going about this a little bit differently. We need to almost get back to the beginning of this epidemic.
Well, I mean, and that's what happened within the gay and lesbian community years ago. You know, we've been struggling with this battle for a lot more years it was probably there all along in the African American community, but it's just that we were the ones out front. We were the ones most
visible,
and for political reasons, we were a good whipping horse as far as HIV was concerned. But those statistics are astounding. You could lose a whole generation.
Yes. And we are.
We really are.
People are. I don't think we realize the impact that this disease has on our community, not just as women or not just as men, but as employers, as employees, as young people young women who want to get married and have children, or even the dynamics in which we talk about issues that have traditionally just been taboo in our community. We are still skirting around, and we'll say things like, "We need to talk about." Well, why can't we talk while we're here?
Why don't we talk about it 45 minutes
saying what we need to talk about later when, we have the opportunity. I think one of the things as a person who is living with HIV, but also someone who obviously has no problem in communicating any issue that I've experienced with this disease to anyone who wants to know, because I think that's the best form of prevention. But the reality is we need to at some point turn around and say, hey, thanks a lot. Because if it wasn't for what happened 25 years ago in a particular community, specifically the gay and lesbian community, there wouldn't be the work and the effort and the money and the resources that are available. And if we can't stop at some point and say, whew, hey, listen, can you tell me what did you do exactly back then, so we can try that now?
Yeah. Well, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on, because one of the things that needs to be built is a coalition between our communities
right.
and on this one issue. issue. If we can't agree on anything else, we can agree on this, that we need to have more information, communication, sharing of our experience and how to handle the pandemic mm-hmm. that's now ravaging mm-hmm. The African-American community.
Mm-hmm. And if we don't start a dialogue, then, you know, we're gonna miss that opportunity. And I think what's unique is we have the opportunity to have personal conversations, one-on-one, and we can say to one another in secrecy or silent, you know, oh, yeah, how did you handle it? Or how did this happen? Or, you know, what were the steps that were taken? But if we don't expand that conversation and allow others to be engaged in it and help them provide questions mm-hmm. that they can go and ask their friends or yeah. their family, then, you know, well, it'll just stay between us.
Well, the astounding thing was I had a conversation with a black politician, elected official, who was astounded by the fact he still had the preconceived notion that once you got AIDS, you just died, that there wasn't, it was the thinking of the 80s, not of the year 2006, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that it was, it's everybody's going to die, but there is a way of extending life if you know, if you catch it early enough and you start taking the necessary efforts and things you can do medically to prolong your own life. Mm-hmm. But if you're in denial behind it, if you're not talking about it, if you don't know the information, it is a death sentence for you at a very young age, unfortunately.
And I wonder what young people think, you know, especially now, you know, ages 13 to 19, you see the rates of infection are going up, particularly among heterosexual youth. And that's disturbing because it makes us, we have to stop and really say, what have we really taught young people over the last 25 years that are growing up with this epidemic? What are those young people who were, you know, babies at the beginning, what are they doing? What are their behaviors? How did you grow up in this society for the last 25 years and not see what's going on around you? It's startling sometimes to really, you know, to get a bird's eye view. I live in the HIV community, so my perception, it's normal. It's ordinary. It's everyday. It's something that I deal with, as I'm sure people deal with whatever their particular issues are. But when I get a chance to travel outside and talk to people who are negative, when they say things like, you know, what about Magic Johnson, the mosquito, the green monkey in Africa, I can almost tell where information stopped, where there was a irk, you know, and we didn't go any further to explore funding, or we didn't go any further to explore rates of infection, changing population, behavior risk. We stopped at some point, and so that's where we have to go back and pick up that conversation and carry it forward.
And that was what I found out in some conversations was that it's like the information stopped. If you have HIV and you're in that community and you're talking about it and you're keeping up with the information, if you aren't in there, your information stopped with the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
You're still working through your head. You still have that same kind of denial
mm-hmm.
that you're indestructible in many cases because you don't have the information on how to protect yourself.
Right, and you have this vision. Mm-hmm. You have a picture in your head of what you've seen on the television. And so you see, you see people who are sickly, or that's the image you still have in your head, because we're still talking about how do people look who have HIV. Well, I thought we dealt with that a while ago, but obviously there's a large portion of the community that still is unaware of the fact that you cannot tell how a person looks who is positive versus someone who is negative. You know, the one thing we say all the time, the minute before you're positive, you're negative. You look the same. Unless something dramatic happens in a minute, it's the same, you're the same person. So we just haven't extended that conversation far enough to really make an impact, I don't think.
Is it just they're not getting the information, the youth? In the African-American community, just aren't getting the information?
No, I don't think it's that the youth aren't getting the information. I feel like maybe it's not, we're not reaching out to as many youth as we could. And this is something that it's so sorely needed. And since it is such a sensitive topic in our community, they might be getting the information at school, but they may not get the information supported from their family or their peers. So I think that's kind of where if we hit more people from different angles and keep pushing the education drive, I think that is really what the key is. Because a lot of times children, they need to hear messages repetitively. Mm-hmm. And I think that's mm-hmm. kind of where we're missing on stuff right now.
And something you said, that's sort of scary. I remember learning about sex in school from the other kids.
Right.
I talk about
right.
a skewed impression and knowledge about it, and
right.
only to find out later on it was all wrong.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's the danger.
And that's what's still going on.
Especially if they're not... If they're talking amongst themselves and not really getting information, what can we do? What can we do?
Well, you know, one thing, when you talk about the young people, I had a friend of mine actually call me to say that she has an 11-year-old daughter, and they were starting the conversation about the body and sex and all the different issues. And she went online to try and find information about HIV and STDs to provide a full comprehensive framework for an 11-year-old mindset. And she called me to tell me that she couldn't find anything. That the information is not available for prepubescent age, 9 to 12, that age when you need to start having that conversation. Mm. So I got online and started, our web searches. And I found information that was useful for parents, to teach a parent how to have a conversation. But this presupposes that the parent has the basic facts and is settled themselves in order to even have that dialogue.
And if the parent's already uncomfortable around
talking
about sex,
they're not going to read the webpage.
They don't want to learn how to talk about it because they don't want to talk about it. Okay.
And it's already hard for us to have a dialogue. And so, one of the things that we have to look at is what information is really available where it is age appropriate. It's going to fit the information that is relevant to a particular age, but still provide our youth with, the foundation so as they move forward, they can make better decisions. A lot of us don't realize that young people who were diagnosed at birth are in high school. And they are engaged in some level of interaction with children. They're same age, older, younger. And so we
cannot... They're having sex is what you're trying to say.
Yeah.
I know it's that thing we well want to talk about.
And they are. And
they're not holding hands anymore.
They're not. No. They're not just winking at each other across the...
Sending little notes.
Yeah. No, they're getting busy in the bathroom.
The real problem, though, comes from the federal government of not wanting to teach sex education.
True.
They basically don't want that word to get down.
Mm-hmm. Comprehensive education is critical. I don't understand, and I've tried. I really have sincerely tried to look objectively at the benefit of abstinence-only education, which is what we provide in the school system. And it's hard to understand. I'm telling someone to not do something. Why? What is the implication of doing this? And we're not willing to provide them with what the implications are of any decision. It doesn't matter if it's related to sex or drug use or what have you. We're not telling them the reasons why and the implications behind that. I'm always so excited when schools will allow us to come in and actually have a free conversation. And God bless principals that allow that to happen with site-based management in the schools. Mm-hmm. It's up to the school, the particular school, to whether or not they want to allow you to come in or not. And then what you're relegated to talk about. And so, the federal government has a role to play. Our policymakers have a tremendous role to play in making these decisions. If we can't get them on board to sign their name to a rule or a law or a bill or an ordinance, then we're just running around, like scattered ants trying to figure out what to do. We need that leadership, and we need that level of guidance.
What is our city government? What can it do? What can the state do? I know y'all are both interacting with the city now. What are we doing right, and what are we doing wrong and can do better?
Well, and if you can give me the exact number, Dina, this year on the 2006-2007 council budget for the year, they increased funding.
Oh, yes.
And it was quite a drastic amount.
I think we went up about an additional $100,000 or so, but there was a request, actually. Councilmember Edwards put forth a request. She put it out there. She's like, forget it. Give me $1 million, you know.
Exactly.
And let's shoot for the stars. And we were able to increase it. And so every year, you know, that's the goal, is to do that type of increase. Right. But we have to have a council member that'll say, give me $1 million every year. That's very important.
Well, that's something we can do. We can find council people who are willing to stand up and say those things, that's what we need. What else can we do?
Really, I feel like you need to have this conversation with your policymakers, and it's easier to start on a grassroots in your city level, but also you need to be talking to your congressmen, your state legislators, because anywhere where additional funding can come for education and prevention, that's really where I just think that it's that's the biggest piece. And if we can educate people, because Black Dems, part of our, our mission statement is educate and empower. Education empowers the community. And if you're educated and you're knowledgeable of what you need to do to prevent, you know, the transmission of the disease, that right there, because in the African-American community, that's just where the biggest thing is, the transmission. And if you can kind of stop it there and educate yourself, any funding for that, I think, is the most desperate need right now.
And thank both of you. How can we get in touch with you?
My number at the office, if you're interested in information about housing or housing opportunities for people with AIDS, you can call me at 713-868-8335.
And my number at the office is 713-247-2013. And if I don't have the answer to the question that you have, I will definitely, you know, get back with you and research it.
All right. We've been talking with Dina Gray and Estelle Stewart. And this is Jennifer Renee. This is Queer Voices. Thank you.
Thank you.
In the 1950s and 60s, a key civil rights...
And this is Ellie, and you've been listening to Alice's My Dear Child. Coming up next is the rest of News Wrap.
This is Queer Voices.
In the 1950s and 60s, a key civil rights leader was given a back seat in the movement he helped create because of his open homosexuality. But today, there are whole communities where residents pride themselves on inclusivity. We'll hear both those stories later in the program, but first, between those extremes, there is the closet case. In a strange way, the closet case might be a serious candidate for 2006 Queer Person of the Year. The messy, high-profile outings of former Republican Congressman Mark Foley and evangelical pastor Ted Haggard helped crack the armor of the religious right, and that contributed to the congressional power shift that's already having an impact on U.S. domestic policy and global perspective, although to what extent remains to be seen. A report by the House Ethics Committee issued on this week's final day of Congress found no rule-breaking, but laid much blame for the Foley scandal at the feet of the Republican leadership. Foley himself reportedly remains in rehab, while a team of evangelical counselors has undertaken Haggard's so-called rigorous restoration plan. To ensure that the closet case won't be forgotten while these infamous examples remain in seclusion, Ron Romanofsky wrote a new song that he's sharing exclusively with This Way Out. Here's the worldwide radio debut of Hard Times for Closet Cases.
Hypocrisy's at an all-time high. Kiss the boys and then deny it. When they find out what you've done, which direction will you run? Religious leaders in high places, politicians with well-known faces, caught in the act and falling from graces. These are hard times for closet cases. Better that they've been exposed, but that don't make a weed a rose. What does it do to our esteem to have these liars on our team? Religious leaders in high places, politicians with well-known faces, engaging in compromising embraces. These are cases. Cases.
is Ron Romanofsky with Hard Times for Closet Cases. You can find out more about Ron's latest music, as well as his earlier hits with Paul Phillips, at RomanofskyandPhillips.com.
Babe Rustin, African-American civil rights activist, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Babe Rustin was born in Pennsylvania in 1910. As a bright young man, he felt compelled to fight injustice. In 1947, he organized the first active protest against segregation on buses in the South. By the late 50s, his expertise as a protest tactician caught the attention of Martin Luther King Jr. Together, they planned the 1963 March on Washington, a 250,000 people strong demonstration for racial equality, during which King delivered his I Have a Dream speech. He then proved pivotal to the civil rights movement. As a result of Rustin's active protest, he endured beatings and was frequently jailed. And because he made no secret of being gay, he was often denied due credit for his brilliant leadership. Clearly, in fighting for his strong convictions about civil rights, Babe Rustin freely accepted personal sacrifice. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Viola Baskerville.
A seasoned women's music icon.
He's a polished young rookie, making waves in the Big Apple. Hi, I'm J.D. Doyle.
I'm Chris Wilson, and they are just two of a talented crop of GLBT musicians we'll present on the Audiophile 2006 Year in Review.
Coming the last week in December, here on This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine.
Hello, my friends.
West Florida is a unique locale, both geographically and socially. Perched off the southeastern tip of the continental U.S., the land residents affectionately call the Conch Republic is known for its well-integrated LGBT community. This Way Out Entertainment reporter Steve Pride vacationed there recently, if you can call it a vacation, when a reporter takes his voice recorder along, and he documented his Key West adventure through the words of the people he met there. Here's the first of Steve's two-part story.
Key West is a city and an island of the same name. It's closer to Havana than Miami, about half the distance, and not real big, only 7.4 square miles. It was where Tennessee Williams wrote A Streetcar Named Desire, and it was the first U.S. town to elect an openly gay mayor. The official motto of Key West is One Human Family, and to the people that live there, it's more than words on a bumper sticker. Recently, I spent time in Key West, and I want to introduce you to some of the people I met there. So I'll shut up now and let them talk.
My name is Carol Shaughnessy. I'm a writer and a almost 30-year Key West resident. I came down here as a naive 20-year-old Minnesota girl. I found a small town where people were friendly. The weather was gorgeous. You were accepted for who you were, and the community gave you the latitude to grow into who you wanted to be. You're judged not on externals, but on what you have to give and what kind of commitment you want to make to the community. It's much more about what's in your heart than what's in your wallet. I found that lack of pretentiousness and that straightforward friendliness to be incredible. I've been here now for almost 30 years, and I can't imagine living anywhere else.
Hi, I'm Tom Oosterhout. I've lived in Key West almost 25 years now. The 70s and 80s were a whole different thing. The Keys was the wild, wild west. This was the center of drug imports for much of America. So you had marijuana and coke flowing. You had a very open gay society because it was pre-AIDS. And I look back, and that certainly was a different time and place than what we have today. Of course, with AIDS, the whole sexual revolution came to a grinding halt, and the feds cracking down on drug running and all that. The whole nature of the Keys and Key West was tamed by the late 80s and 90s. So the Key West you see today is a very tame Key West, although it's still a wonderful place that cherishes its diversity. Although many major metropolitan cities claim huge ethnic populations, Key West, we have just about everybody represented here, but because it's a 1.5-mile by 4-mile long island, it's tiny, and we all have to work and play side by side. So if you're gay, straight, black, white, Catholic, Jew, whatever, you're working side by side with someone that's probably very different than you. I mean, they could be a gay, black, Puerto Rican. You never know here. So not only do we cherish our diversity, we live it. We make it a way of life.
When I first came to Key West in the late 70s, it was definitely not a tourist community. It was a commercial fishing community, and again, it was quite poor at that time. The gay community played an incredible part in the revitalization of Key West, buying the old beautiful Victorians, which unfortunately mostly were held together by termite spit because, as I said, it was a poor community, restoring these houses to their former glory, opening guest houses, opening businesses. The gay community played a very big and very welcome part in the creation of the Key West that visitors will see today.
My name is Neil Chamberlain. I'm a resident of Key West. I own the gay information website, pistolandenema.com, the largest gay information website in Key West. I'm very fortunate in the business I run. I love it. Not many people can do what they love and make a living at it. I get to go out to the clubs, hang out with my friends, meet new people constantly. When you get into the gay and straight lines, there are many people that have been coming here since the early 80s and 90s that wanted to stay at like a male-only resort or a female-only resort. They kind of made their own segregation in a way by doing that. Even though they were welcome anywhere in Key West, they felt more comfortable in the company of just men or just women. We are a very blended community, and I think in a way it has hurt us in the fact that some people do want to come down and stay at a gay resort or go to a gay club. Technically, we have just a few gay clubs in a small area. However, all of our clubs are all welcome. But a lot of people, when they come down, they say, what gives? This is supposed to be such a gay community. Why are there only 5 gay clubs? Well, there are 5 clubs that are identified as gay, but, you know, there's another 70 that anyone can go into.
My name's Heather Carruthers, and I'm a co-owner of Pearl's Rainbow here in Key West. Pearl's Rainbow is the largest resort for women in the world. We've got 38 rooms and suites and 2 pools, 2 hot tubs, a restaurant, a poolside bar. All our rooms have private baths. We've been in existence since 2000. The property itself has been here and operating as a women's space since 1989.
Hello, I'm Gary Walker from the Equator Resort in Key West, Florida. The Equator Resort's going on its 10th year here in Key West. We have all male. I'd say the average age is anywhere between, I'd say, 35 to 45. We have 19 rooms here on site, and it has that southern hospitality. I'm a southern girl, honey.
My name is Philippe, working at Alexander's Guest House. The guest house has been open, gay, lesbian for the past 25 years. We have mostly couples, I would say, from 25 up to 75. Yeah. And the 75, they've been together for like 30 years and 40 years, and they've been here for like the past 10 years, year after year. They always come back.
Gary Tinlin, I'm the Vice President and General Manager of Oasis Coral Tree Inn and Coconut Grove. People who come down here often buy down here, because they love that laid-back, easy-going lifestyle. I think one of the big attractions is that this is the end of the road. You can't go any further than Key West. That's out into the ocean, 160 miles off the mainland. Those are attractions to people who can afford to buy a second home here, which is a lot of the commerce that goes on, or buy a home here and move here.
Hi, I'm Martha Robinson. I am a full-time realtor for 20 years in Key West, Florida. We've had a wonderful ride for many, many years. We've watched everybody renovate our homes and the conch houses and in Newtown, Old Town, Midtown, and then with the hurricanes, so many of them last year. And then we had the flood for the last one, Wilma, and that kind of devastated a lot of folks. It was very, very difficult, and everything just seemed to stop. In my opinion, this adjustment has has not been so horrible because it is allowing other people to buy right now. I mean, we're talking about $400,000 to $500,000 as being affordable. However, a little tiny condominium unit did just sell in the $269,000 range.
I can't imagine living anywhere else, but the cost of living is very high. And a lot of people come here with the idea of living in paradise. And it is paradise, but it's an expensive paradise. Employment is very tough down here. Getting good employees is tough. We jokingly say anybody that shows up for work on the second day is a long-term employee. There's plenty of jobs. If you're willing to come down here and work hard, you'll do fine.
I'm not quite ready to move, but I can't wait to get back there for a visit. My thanks to Carol, Tom, Neil, Heather, Philippe, Jerry, and Martha. In part two of our visit, we'll meet a few more island folk, including the head of the Key West Rooster Rescue, a nude go-go boy who heals with his hands, and the former queen mother of Key West. More info about Key West can be found online at pistolandenema.com, and as always, there's more at prideonscreen.com. Until next time, this is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Nibbling on sponge cake, watching the sun bake, all of those tourists.
Hello, I'm Dr. Robert Simmons, Jr. of Lebanon, Ohio, a longtime This Way Out listener and donor. In memory of my mother, Mabel Simmons, I'm issuing a matching challenge to supporters of this volunteer-driven nonprofit operation. Please visit thiswayout.org to see how your help to keep this program on the air will now be worth twice as much. You'll also get a tax deduction if you're in the United States, and you'll find some unique holiday gifts there too. Again, please log on to thiswayout.org. We'll all be very thankful.
There's no time to lose. This offer ends December 31st. Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Rick Watts, Charles Hall, Rex Walker with Bill Kelly, Graham Underhill, Ron Romanofsky, Judd Proctor, and Brian Burns with Viola Baskerville, and Steve Pride contributed program material. The Carnival Street Drum Band and Jimmy Buffett performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out anytime, exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also click on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Most This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from you, our listeners, and we thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to help keep this program on the air. Remember, your support is worth twice as much to us until the end of the year. And you can choose from some special CD thank you gifts, too. You can email us at tworadio@aol.com or write to us at Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on 2UUU, Nowra, New South Wales, KRUX, Las Cruces, New Mexico, WRPI, Troy, New York, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This is Queer Voices.
You know, I was looking in the calendar section of Outsmart, and there isn't, like, a lot of stuff. Most of the stuff happened, because a lot of the, you know, community events that are, like, special for the holidays happen early in the month, because people either go home or they've got their own stuff going on. But I do want to say I went to see the movie Bobby.
Yeah, how was that?
That was very interesting. Now, is there a GLBT angle? Well, I think there was an angle more or less about, you know, the leadership of the country. And it was interesting. It wasn't the greatest movie I ever saw, but it was good. What was really interesting, though, is that actually, and it's about Bobby Kennedy,
right,
the day he died in the hotel that he was staying in at the time, and it was the California primary, was that when they actually showed pictures of Bobby Kennedy, it was footage that they found. They injured,
really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yes,
and incredible.
It's sort of like an Altman film where there's all these different stories going on, and they intersect at one time. Rather interesting. Now, maybe a movie that we could say is somewhat about our community is a movie called Dreamgirls.
Yes.
Which is opening
I've heard
Christmas
a lot of
Day.
Good stuff about that.
Well, it was interesting because, you know, it's about, we're running out of time here.
Ooh, yes.
But it's about a women's group and the men who run it behind the scenes.
Yes.
But it was interesting on BBC America, what they said was that there's definitely a gay angle in there because a lot of the creative process that putting that movie between taking it from the stage and making it a movie were gay people.
Yes. Yes.
And you're listening to Queer Voices.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Walensky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
In my opinion, what a drag king means to people all around the world. And we have put so much thought into who we wanted to be here, and we wanted to bring you a taste of the activism and the grassroots momentum that Leslie Feinberg carries. And we just want to welcome the authors Don't Butch Blues, Transgender Warriors, Trans Liberation, and Now Drag King Dreams. Afterwards, you can buy books by Bookwoman outside on the patio, and come up to the quadrangle room in the drag strip to get them signed by Leslie personally. So make your way up to room 3.304 after you get your books. Thank you, and welcome to Leslie Feinberg.
Buenos dias. What other word should I use to open up a conference that is held on land that was stolen from Mexico? A segregated city in which we are fighting for change. I thank the organizers of IDK 8 and of the Austin Dragsters for doing every single thing that was in their power to bring me here and make this an easy, smooth, wonderful trip for me. And then there were the things that were out of their power. And so, I'm standing before you with almost no sleep on a flight that got in at the equivalent of 3 a.m. for me without them ever telling us why. My suit, my beautiful secondhand sharkskin suit and the clothes I was going to wear today have somehow disappeared in the airport. And so I stand here in the clothes I've been wearing for 2 days traveling. Most of them sitting on the tarmac with a dehydration nosebleed that could begin at any moment during this talk. So when I tell you I am thrilled to be here with you, you know I mean it. Here we are, charting uncharted territory. What a responsibility that is for all of us. And what an excitement that we live in a moment where we can create change. The imperative is for us to create change. When I first came out in the very early 1960s, and I should qualify what that means because as a very masculine girl child growing up in the 1950s McCarthyite anti-communist, anti-gay, anti-Jewish witch hunt, it really meant coming out into community. I was already out of being what was considered genderqueer in a Dick and Jane gender educational system. When I came out into community, it was at that time, and I'm just going to ask people if they could hold off just for a little while taking flash pictures, because I'm truly disoriented visually in every other way. When I first came out, it was into bars that I cannot separate out from you. Were they lesbian bars? Were they gay bars? Were they drag bars? They were the bars that blue-collar people who were labeled genderqueer or who were labeled cross-dressers. And I can, again, I have to stop and say, look at the language we have to use. I mean, you can only be considered gender-bent in a society that's gender-rigid. And the cross-dressing implies that there's a great Rubicon and you're on one side or the other. But we were the tip of the iceberg of what was considered sexual and gender queerness. And nobody had really, at that period of time in the U.S., seen the entire iceberg rise. I say that because there were earlier movements for sexual and gender and sex liberation. But at that time, we were the ones that the factory bosses could see coming down the street, saying the agency, the rent-a-day agency, has sent another he-sheet. Here it comes down the street. So when we went to the bars, dressed in our finery, the finest clothes that we could buy from secondhand stores or from Army-Navy stores, and I'll get to the point about military attire soon. That was all we had to wear. And we dressed up and we taught each other how to tie a half Windsor or a full Windsor. And we got up on the stage with our drag queen sisters. And people who desired us, who respected us, who saw their dignity reflected in ours, cheered for us. Wow. That was a moment of pre-Stonewall pride. A moment of personhood, of being recognized for our humanity, being appreciated for it, feeling strong and feeling beautiful and handsome and desired. It was an amazing experience. It felt powerful. And it was powerful in the sense that we were building our own personhood, our own pride, and our own communities. But when someone pulled the plug on the jukebox and the cops came in the front door, or the bashers had the place surrounded and we had to come out fighting, or we were dragged out handcuffed and taunted by the cops and humiliated and reminded that the sentence for not wearing three pieces of women's clothing or three pieces of men's clothing would be very likely carried out that night in the back seat of a police cruiser or on the cold cement floor of a precinct cell. We did not have power. We did not. There was a real relationship of forces outside that bar that suddenly came crashing through the front door. And what really changed our lives, partly, I believe, was that we came together in community and cheered each other and found our strength and our dignity and our personhood and our pride with each other. But then we organized politically. Because when you think about it, the histories of oppression in this country, people of color, women, populations that have been out, visible for the most part to the dominant society, and yet have been oppressed and repressed and discriminated against and downtrodden and disenfranchised until an independent movement arose that went out into the streets, that rallied, that rebelled, that picketed, that really created political change in the name of all who were under its banner. All who were under its banner. And many marched under that banner. You know, even at times when that banner was a single-issue banner, because of the ascendant political current demanded a single-issue banner. As Audre Lorde said, there's no such thing as a single-issue movement because we do not lead single-issue lives. Frederick Douglass said it best, I think, the most succinctly, certainly, that without struggle there is no progress. And you know, Frederick Douglass is a great defender of women's and gender rights. He was the only man of the 31 men who were at the Seneca Falls Women's Conference in 1848 to take the podium. And he said something so eloquent. He said, our doctrine is that right is of no sex. And for this support of women's rights, he was gay baited, he was feminine male baited, he was intersexual baited. Like many of the men and women who fought slavery, who fought for women's rights, he was called an Aunt Nancy's man, he was called a hermaphrodite. As you know, Sojourner Truth was forced on occasions to strip to the waist by white middle-class men who demanded to know if this powerful abolitionist who stood more than 6 feet tall, whose voice was described as rolling thunder, who rippled with the muscle of a lifetime of enforced and slave labor, was really a man in women's clothing. But Douglass, just before his death, said something that has so much meaning to me in terms of coalition building and activism. After a lifetime of having been baited, his manhood baited, for having the courage to come out for women's rights as well as the abolition of chattel slavery in this country, he spoke to a group of women shortly before his death, and if I may be allowed to quote him, he said, when I ran away from slavery, it was for myself. When I advocated emancipation, it was for my people. When I advocated for women's rights, self was out of the question. And in doing so, I found a little nobility in the act. I know we use the language of kings and emperors and princes and princesses and queens, but I believe that the kind of nobility which Frederick Douglass described is the only nobility to which we should aspire, and that is to strive to be the best fighters against each other's oppression. There have been many historical periods around the globe in going back from when ritual became performance, in which performance of oppressed gender expressions has been allowed to exist without direct attack or oppression in terms of the performances themselves. I'm thinking, for example, of the Weimar Republic in Germany during the German homosexual emancipation movement, which you can't really separate out whether it was gay or bi or lesbian or trans because of the identification or the self-conceptualization at that time of gay homosexuality as being people having the brain of one sex in the body of another. So it's kind of hard to separate out based on those LGBTQ acronym that we have today. But it certainly had a strong trans component. And in Weimar, in the Weimar Republic in Germany, before the rise of fascism and across Western Europe at that time, there was a lot of drag performance. It was crushed. It was crushed along with the workers' movement of Germany, the Jewish population, the trade unionists, the communists, the Romani, the disabled. But even before the rise of fascism, the German homosexual emancipation movement hit a crossroads with the rise on the eve of World War I. And I think this is important today because any performance that takes place today and any movement building, any coalition building, any activism or political discussion that takes place today does so in a period of imperialist war and the increased racism and reaction that goes with it, along with that Rambo mentality of gender. And the German homosexual emancipation movement leadership, along with the socialist leadership of the rising workers' movement on the eve of World War I, was asked this question that every movement has to take a position on the eve of an imperialist or colonial war, and that is, where do you stand? Well, I'm not going to use stand anymore. I'm trying to get rid of all ableist language in my vocabulary. What position will you take in relation to war and racism? And the leadership of that movement collapsed. They collapsed and supported their own rulers in what was a racist colonial war for empire. And if you cannot confront as a movement that kind of racism and reaction coming from the rulers that you're taking on as an independent movement, then it's no longer an independent movement, and those who are the most revolutionary and the most progressive get isolated and pushed back, and those who are the most reactionary get emboldened and are taller in the saddle, and the next thing you know, the movement for gender and sexual and sex rights was crushed. And it was crushed at a time when the peoples of Africa and Asia and Latin America were fighting against colonial occupation that was not so unlike what the U.S. and Britain and the other imperial powers are trying to reinstitute today for any country that is fighting for a modicum of its right to self-determination and sovereignty. And so, had the movements been able to reach out and express their solidarity with those who were in the crosshairs of colonialism, what a powerful movement might have been built. In this country, I remember that around the turn of the last century, the 20th century, that drag was really in its golden heyday in vaudeville. It was considered appropriate entertainment for women and children. You know how impressionable women and children can be. And how easily entertained by what was supposed to be, what was billed as legitimate because it was simply a magic act. It was just an illusion. But when Mae West created her play, The Pleasure Man, that demonstrated drag performers who were as genderqueer offstage as they were onstage, the police came in and shut it down. The great Harlem drag balls, the Hamilton drag ball that drew, I think, by the early decade of the 1900s, 8,000 people, black and white, many of them working class. All of these performances that had once risen where, you know, they were taking place in the Savoy or they were taking place, you know, in Washington, D.C., in New York, were driven underground. So there are these periods where performance is allowed to rise, sometimes only on the level of superstardom and sometimes only on the level of a Hollywood performance. Don't worry, this actor who's coming up here clutching the Golden Globe or the Academy Award, look how they really were pretending to be someone that they're not. Does harm, I think, not only to those of us who are, but to those who are bi-gender. Because it implies that anybody who's up there on that stage is just pretending to be something that they're not, and it really does great harm to the fact that there are many people in this room, in this world, who, for whom one gender expression is not enough. And there is no room or language for bi-gender and tri-gender and multi-gender and gender-ambiguous and gender-contradictory expression. It just continues to close up the space that we're in, so we're back in those little stick-figured doors, when meanwhile Jay Davidson, who did an amazing performance in what was a reactionary anti-Irish liberation movie, The Crying Game, an anti-woman I would add too, very misogynist movie, but when Jay Davidson was the talk of the Academy Awards, there was no statue for Jay Davidson if there was just jokes. And would Jay Davidson have gotten Best Actor or Best Actress? That was the joke, but that was the reality. There was no, you know, imagine that airbrushed statue only being able to be given on the basis of genitalia. There are periods in history where what's considered sexually outlaw and what's considered gender outlaw have come together, not only in populations and community organizing, like when I first came out, where, like I said, we couldn't separate out which part of us was genderqueer and which part of us was sexually queer. We were felons in every state. And I remember before Sylvia Rivera died, some of you know Sylvia Rivera was a Latina, self-identified at that time as a drag queen during the Stonewall Rebellion. She was a combatant and a leading combatant in the Stonewall Rebellion. She had lived homeless on the streets of New York as a transgender youth since she was 10 years old. And I said, Sylvia, people ask me, was it a gay rebellion or was it a trans rebellion? And I just say, yes. What do you say? I said, would you say that you fought back because you were gay, because you were a drag queen, because you were Latina, because you were homeless, because you had to turn tricks to survive, because you knew all about in your body the brutality of the police and the prison system, because you didn't have a draft card that night to produce when the government agents demanded it? And her answer was so succinct and so eloquent, I'll never forget it. Sylvia said, we were fighting for our lives. It goes back to what Audrey said. There is no such thing as a single issue movement because we do not lead single issue lives. I don't want to create any gender theory that makes more compartments and more definitions that more bodies and more lives and more self-expression cannot find themselves in. For me, theory is about the distillation of experience. And if it really crystallizes experience, decades, centuries, or individuals, then it offers a direction for which way forward, how we got to where we are today, the histories, not history, but histories that led to this moment we're at, and how to find our way forward. For myself, I'm willing to describe myself as a masculine female as long as it's an outlaw status. I'm willing to claim it. I don't use masculine about myself as a noun, but as an adjective. And as an adjective in relation to another noun. In other words, masculine female for me conjures, at least in the public imagination, that there appears to be a social contradiction between my sex and gender expression. And as long as that is outlawed and as long as that has no representation in the dominant culture, I'm willing to be forward and claim it. But I don't want to essentialize myself as masculine either. I actually chafe at describing myself as masculine. I wrote in Transliteration, Beyond Pink or Blue, I wrote, for one thing, masculinity is such an expansive territory, encompassing boundaries of nationality, race, and class. Most importantly, individuals blaze their own trails across this landscape. And it's hard for me to label the intricate matrix of my gender as simply masculine. To me, branding my own individual self-expression as simply masculine or feminine is like asking a poet, do you write in English or Spanish? The question leaves out the possibilities that this poetry is woven in Cantonese or Ladino, Swahili or Arabic. And the question deals only with the system of language that the poet has been taught. It ignores the words each writer calls up, hand over hand from a common well. The music words make when finding themselves next to each other for the first time. The silences echoing in the spaces between ideas. The powerful winds of passion and belief that move the poet to write. I believe that theory as a guide to action has to be rooted in the economic and social reality of which it analyzes. And so any discussion about gender and its relation to patriarchy has to, I believe, go back and look at the fact that gender expression existed before patriarchy. And that is an embattled field on which to even assert that there has ever been a time in human history when all of our ancestors on every continent lived in societies that don't look anything like the Flintstones or the Honeymooners or the projection of the Jetsons in the future. That in fact, there were cooperative societies in which universal scarcity meant that there was a group cohesion. And that individuals were a part of the group, and in which blood descent was traced through the mother, through females, which is a profoundly different bloodline system than the patriarchy. It wasn't a matriarchy in the sense of Xena warrior princess, you know, with women ruling over men. It wasn't a utopia. But the fact is that why is it that we have to fight so hard just to demonstrate that it hasn't always been this way? I think because that's a deeply subversive idea. If it hasn't always been this way, and it's not just that we are hardwired in our human nature to be basically greedy and bigoted and mean-spirited and rotten, like we've met the enemy and it is us, then it means that things could change again. And all of my work with transgender warriors as a book was to demonstrate the fact that different forms of economic organization have produced different social relations. And so when I opened up in 1975 a book called Living the Spirit by Gay American Indians, the organization GAI, and turned to the back and saw that besides these amazing, this compilation, this anthology of writings, that here was a chart that GAI had put together of what they referred to as alternative sex/gender roles in 135 Native nations on this continent, and that they were not patriarchal, father knows best, have and have not societies. They were diverse and complex societies with different cultures and languages and different organization of sexes and genders and kinship. This is a powerful tool and a powerful weapon in the struggle today against patriarchal class society that says it's always been this way. And let's face it, who is it that went in and carried out the cultural genocide and continues to? The colonial and imperial cultural genocide has worked overtime to try to say, to try to erase the histories of the people that it occupies in order to say that the way things are now is basically the way they've always been. So just to struggle against that concept is in fact a component of the anti-colonial and anti-imperialist movement. The earliest edicts that I could find and I was drawing on more than a century of Marxists, including women's liberationists and national liberationists histories. The trails had already been blazed for me. The earliest edicts I could find that not only separated the sexes into either or and executed or severely demonized any bodies that fell in between, that reduced and overthrew the historic status of females, that mandated gender expression, that policed it, and that made sexuality a matter of state repression were in the first cleavages of societies into have and have-nots, or the colonial or imperial intervention of countries like England and Spain and Portugal and later the U.S. that went and brought anti-sodomy laws. Now, you know, sodomy doesn't come from the Quran, as they're Islam bashing. You know, it comes from the Bible. And with Bibles and bullets took these both sexuality laws, these anti-gay laws for the shorthand, and anti-gender laws, and imposed them from India to Thailand, throughout Africa and Latin America. The anti-gay law in Puerto Rico was instituted in 1898, and it was copied from the exact same wording as the California law that existed on the books at that time. So today, I believe that all of the lessons, and there are so many more, and so many from other people's histories, both oppressed peoples here and around the world, that would enrich what has been a dominant official history that is an official white history in which people of color contributions and struggles have been footnoted, if they are footnoted at all. Is that today we have the opportunity to move forward with a new new conceptualization of the paths that brought us here together. And in doing so, we can forge the way forward, whether we're going to walk it, roll it, or tap our way forward, doing it together. And one of the things I wanted to raise was a joke, not a joke, a game that...
You're listening to 90.1 KPFT, a Pacifica station, and we are currently listening to Leslie Feinberg's speech at the International Drag King Extravaganza, which was originally in Austin, Texas, October 19th through 22nd. About 1,500 people attended, and back to the speech.
We used to play. Often it was at alcohol-soaked parties. And you know, when the mix of alcohol and drugs with shame and humiliation and fear and rage is a volatile mixture, and people can get hurt when that happens. But there was a game that we used to play at parties before Stonewall. And it was about rating people based on butchness. Now, why not feminists? It shows a certain devaluation of femininity here. But the game was a degree of 1 to 10. And one of the butches would stand in the middle of the room and people around them would rate them from 1 to 10 in degrees of butchness. Well, what was interesting was how different the evaluations were of each individual from the observers, the audience. Somebody would say, "You gave her a 9? Are you kidding? I gave her a 4. So there was the outward experience of the person's gender expression, and then there was the outraged person in the middle of the room saying, "You gave me a 4? I'm not leaving the middle of this circle till you give me at least a 10. Now, I wouldn't play that game if anyone asked me to today, because what it did, in my opinion, is to create a vertical hierarchy of gender expression for who was the mostest and the bestest of masculine. Or that could be true if the game had been played with feminine too. What I think is that it showed that it took at least 10 degrees, it took a numerical range to be able to show, even within a very select group of black and white and Native and Latina butchers who worked in the same plants, had similar work experiences, and met together at the bars, although they had very different experiences in terms of the carrying the multiple burdens of oppression. that just saying masculine or butch was not enough. Here, even 10 degrees didn't sum up the variance of how people saw individuals, of how individuals saw themselves. And I raise that because we have so little language to talk about this, even today, where there are so many more gender expressions in the room. You know, I feel like if I turned on the Weather Channel before I came here to Houston, assuming I had a choice of what to wear. Austin, I'm sorry. Oh my gosh. My head is in the abolition of the death penalty movement, which is going to be here next week, and I've been dealing with Austin, with Houston all week, and I apologize. If I was trying to figure out what to wear here in Austin, what the weather was going to be, and I turned on the Weather Channel, and all of meteorological science was reduced to the words hot and cold. And they said it's going to be hot and hot and hot and hot, and then it's going to be cold. What would I wear? What I see today happening is an opening up of a potential for an understanding that even in a society where we've been issued two bolts of cloth, one of each of two bolts of cloth, you know, pink or blue, look at what each of us as individuals has fashioned from this social bolt of cloth. And look at the variation of human expression that we have defended even when we have suffered enormous penalties for it. And look at how we have found each other and cheered each other from the audiences for getting up here and literally being who we are. Even back when I came out, there was a big struggle between those who I would say, like myself, are unigender. Like, what you see is what there is. This is my gender expression. Look at me going to grade school. Look at me now. Here's the arc. This is how I express myself. This is my gendered language. I strive to be more multilingual in other ways, but this is my gender articulation. There was always a struggle between those who came to the shows on Saturday night at the bars and who were either bi-gender or who lived in a very modified gender existence during the week in order to have a job and a community and a place to live. And this struggle was not unlike what I've heard aimed at my bisexual allies, which is that you aren't living it. See, I'm living it, but you can just put it on and off. You're just playing, and this isn't a game for me. Well, I'm here to say gender isn't a game for anybody, but we have a right to play. And it's one of the things that I want to defend, and it's one of the things that Drag King Dreams takes up is really an ongoing self-examination of someone with one gender who assails someone who is bi-gendered and then doesn't ever have the chance to say they're sorry for the judgments they made about their friend's life. I think there's a very powerful dialectical relationship between the individual and society, and that to say that our gender expression is just socially constructed means that some of us just are not very good learners, or weren't, you know, were out of school that day when you taught gender. And if rape and institutionalization and threats of imprisonment and beatings and humiliation and lack of jobs and health care and housing, if those things didn't change our gender expression, then in fact perhaps there is something very deep and abiding in how we see ourselves and present ourselves to the world and what we've done with the social messages of what it means to be our sex and ourselves. And I want to make room for more. And I want to help create languages that also recognize you and me as we see ourselves, as we experience ourselves, as we want to project ourselves, and as we want to be understood. I also chafe at the creating of a continuum between butches and trans men. It's a pitting of transgender lives and transsexual lives that we cannot allow to have happen. Those who try to equate the trans male experience as being just butches who are passing, it's not right. It does injustice to butches. It does injustice to trans men. It harkens back to that my gender expression means I'm just trying to be like a man, and it says to my trans male brothers that they are somehow hiding who they really are, as though being a trans man is so much easier than being a butch lesbian in society. But it also doesn't explore the relationship of gender variance within the trans male population and says there's only one way to express your gender as a trans man. It puts gender and sex on the same continuum as two poles. And the argument that gender fluidity or gender contradiction or gender ambiguity is so much more liberated than trans men and trans women who are upholding the binary and defending the binary is also a reactionary argument. Nobody's gender and nobody's sex and nobody's sexuality is liberated in this society until all of ours are. And it's reminiscent of an experiment that took place, a social experiment in second wave feminism, which was an important one. And I have to preface this because, you know, this whole attack on the women's liberation movement, the second wave, as being feminazis, is both anti-Jewish, it's a slur against the women's movement, and it comes from the Rush Limbaughs. Movements make mistakes, just like individuals, because they're made up of individuals. And we're only as conscious as we are conscious. What's unconscious is not conscious yet. You know, we make mistakes. We have to learn from them. The women's movement saw how deeply gender education was instilled in boys and girls from growing up from an early age and tried to find a way towards human liberation, not just for women, for females, but for everyone in society by trying to do away with gender because it was so soaked, so saturated with the attitudes of supremacy and inferiority. Well, after a while, first of all, if those who weren't between the, if we weren't in the room, it wasn't a full discussion about gender expression. And after a while, it got narrowed down to, you know, well, it's just me and you, and I'm not so sure about you. You know, because after all, who's really in the middle enough? You know, and after a while, if people like me are considered to be, you know, dupes of the patriarchy, and femme sisters and brothers are considered to be, you know, selling out to the patriarchy, then the only liberated space is androgyny. Now, androgyny is a very liberating space if you are androgynous. I think the lesson of it is that, yes, all the attitudes about femininity and masculinity are completely drenched in prejudiced ideas that are meant to justify patriarchal and institutionalized oppression. We need all of us, salut, we need all of us together in the movement to be able to change it. We need to be able to defend each other's gender expression. It's not your tie that's oppressing me. It's not your lipstick that's oppressing me. There is an institutionalized mechanism of oppression that profits from this inequity. And at the same time, let's get together and not allow any of those attitudes to get repeated as just being playful. When I hear things like, it's part of why I wrote Stonebridge Blues, when I heard butches say, oh, you know, my femme, she's, oh, you could expect she'll be an hour late, she's probably shopping, you know, for the 20th pair of black shoes. That is a distillation of woman hating that none of us can repeat without shooting ourselves in the foot and our sisters, our femme sisters. We need these spaces that IDKE8 And the Austin Dragsters have created for us here and in other places, you know, every year and around our movement, to be able to have these discussions, thoroughgoing discussions, in which there will be so many contributions and insights and experiences, many of which are in this room. And also to take into account that whether it's performance or coalition building, it takes place in the real world of economics and social injustice. And right now, this conference, salute, we're all getting the flu here. Right now, it's taking place in an era of imperialist war in which the imperialist powers are trying to use sex and gender and sexuality liberation to justify the wars. When you hear Laura Bush use the words women's liberation, you know we gotta redefine it and take it back. Remember, they said they were going into Afghanistan in order to liberate women, that the Taliban was oppressive to women. Well, they ought to know, because when there was a democratic revolution in Afghanistan that asked the Soviet Union to come in and defend them, it was the U.S. Army that put out a manual that talked about the gains for women who had been living under feudal oppression and how the bride price was abolished and women had jobs and were part of the leadership. And the U.S. went in and drowned that in blood with some of the same forces that it later said, now let us go in and overthrow them. And why? Because they wanted a UNICAL pipeline through Afghanistan. And so now the president of Afghanistan is a former executive of UNICAL. And the ambassador of the U.S. to Afghanistan is a former executive to UNICAL. We have to be able to lay bare what this economic machinery is of global capitalist expansion, that whenever it hits an obstacle, suddenly they don't say, come on, youth, come follow us, come kill or be killed for big oil and for UNICAL and for Halliburton to make the world safe for capitalist profit. That's not popular. They have to say, they make it seem as though the Pentagon has suddenly become a vehicle for women's and gay liberation. And now, watch how they'll try to use gay sexuality and transsexualism to try to carry out yet another regime change in Iran, because the people of Iran have sit on top of oil. They know all about what regime change looks like. They lived under the Shah of Iran, which the U.S. and the British oil companies reinstituted, and trained the Savak with the CIA like the School of the Assassins to teach the Savak how to torture the population. And they kicked the imperialists out, and they've taken over their own oil, and they have a right to define their own liberation. And so do the people of North Korea. I grew up in the witch hunt, in which the early gay liberationists who were revolutionaries went out and defended the Korean people and came out against the Korean War at a time when they could have gone to jail and been castrated or lobotomized for it. And the fact is that the U.S. killed 4 million Korean women and men and children, is still got tens of thousands of troops on its borders, reportedly has nuclear weapons attacking, has spy planes over its head, has aircraft carriers, is economically strangling them, and then says the North Korean people are paranoid to think that the U.S. is going to attack. We've got to be able to say we know what the wars against Asia have meant, from Korea to Vietnam and to Korea and Laos and Cambodia. We will not let these wars be carried out in our names. Let's declare unilateral peace with the peoples of the world and say this government and this military does not act in our interest. And there's another aspect about the defense of Korea and defense of Cuba. And right now there's 5 Cuban prisoners in U.S. jails serving life sentences. And for what? For trying to monitor acts of terror that were being organized out of Miami and other places in the U.S. against their island nation. Now, doesn't the U.S. say this is a war on terror, a war against terror? And yet the Cuban Five were trying to stop terror attacks from the U.S., and they are in prison. And we do not hear their names, and why not? Because it would show what a dirty war the U.S. has been carrying out for half a century against people who are not just trying to defend their self-determination and sovereignty. They are trying to set up the way people who enslaved peoples of African descent tried to set up maroon communities and break from slavery and were encircled by the landed slave owners who tried to invade and re-enslave and reshackle people. You know, it's easy now to talk about slavery and the courage of the abolitionists like Frederick Douglass, because that is no longer the dominant economic mode in the U.S., except in the U.S. prison system. But the fact is that today, to speak out against capitalism, to break with McCarthyism and its legacy, to be able to say, I am a revolutionary, I am a communist, I want to see a world in which everyone eats and everyone is clothed and everyone has housing and education is free and health care is free, but not just that people have what they need, but what they need and desire in order to grow. That is demonized today. That's what takes a struggle today. And so I have a lot of things that I've schlepped. My clothing's been lost, but luckily my literature has not. And as an organizer, I'm happiest about that. I have newspapers, of which I've written an article about Foleygate and how what it means to have the Democratic Party now be attacking the Republicans from the right in order to try to push through this anti-gay myth, this fascist myth that same-sex love is inherently connected to child rape. What an abuse of children this is, in addition to our loves and lives. And I also have a few hundred of I've had four and three-quarters books published, and the three-quarters is up online, and it's called Lavender and Red, and it's about what our struggles and demand to end sex, gender, and sexuality oppression, how we have come together and found support with revolutionary movements since the German homosexual emancipation movement. So I say to you, I am so thrilled to be here, and I was so happy when I got here, and I looked in this booklet, and I saw that there was going to be a discussion, that there was a discussion yesterday about racism and performance. I was so excited to hear how well attended it was. But before I saw that, I saw something about performing blackness. And at first, I got a chill. I got a shiver because I wondered who it was that was putting on the workshop. And was it a how-to workshop? I mean that very seriously. And then I read it, and I saw it said, this workshop will address issues of drag and racial performance, specifically performing black characters and cultures. Performances of black people happen in the context of a long history of grotesquely distorted images that continues until this day. And then I knew I was in the right place. We have a right to express our identities and all of who we are. And when we get up on a stage, we are responsible for the messages that we convey. And as an audience, we are responsible for what we enforce and don't reinforce from performances. And that's as important as the performers up here on the stage. We are in a period in which Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo have tried to incorporate anti-trans images, anti-trans humiliation, anti-gay degradation and rape as part of the science of torture. And the Rambo mentality is being pushed as you can almost feel that kind of father knows best, Nick at Night approach to sex and gender coming back. But we have an opportunity now to unite as we never have before, because as the cities are being starved to pay for the war and people are awakening to the need to struggle, When we see the kinds of oppressions that are taking place, the roundup of Arab and South Asian and Muslim people, and believe me, I live in the third largest per capita immigrant population of the U.S. in New Jersey and Jersey City, and we all know neighbors and co-workers who are being disappeared. For those who ask how could Japanese Americans have been rounded up during World War II and interned in concentration camps in California, in Arizona, and Nevada, this is how it begins. When we see the lie that undocumented immigrant workers are coming over here and stealing something from the economy, when in fact this economy stole the land from immigrant workers, goes over across the borders, drives people here to the imperialist centers to try to find work, and then create billions for the economy and get back pennies, if anything, in return, then surely we as trans people who are going to lose our licenses under the Real ID Act have every reason to unite. There's no such thing as a single-issue movement. We do not live single-issue lives. We have got to take responsibility to find ways to unite with sensitivity, with self-education. I'm reminded Audre Lorde, when she was speaking to the Stores Conference, and I'll end on this, at the NWSA, the National Women's Studies Association, she talked about the uses of anger. And she called upon white women there to put down the shields of defensiveness and guilt, which are used both offensively against the anger of people of color against racism, and are also used as barriers to self-learning and growth and development. To be able to approach each other, to be able to say, let us know each other as allies in the struggle together, not just by our words, but by our performances, by our deeds. Thank you.
Listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Holiday Blues Workshop Series happens Saturday, December 16th at noon. Join us in a discussion on self-esteem, knowledge, and power. The workshop will include resources for health and human services such as job information and training. Food, entertainment, and inspiration will also be in abundance. Free admission and free transportation will be provided for people affected by the hurricanes. This event is being held at the Aquaba Center, 5317 Martin Luther King Boulevard, Houston, Texas, 77021, next to the Shrine of the Black Madonna, and is presented by the Coalition of Urban Resource Experts and funded by United Way and the Katrina Rita Fund of Houston as part of Project Resilience. You are listening to listener-sponsored KPFT Houston.
The Finance Committee of the Pacifica National Board of Directors has proposed an amendment to Article 6, Section 1 of the Pacifica Bylaws. This amendment would reduce the required number of annual in-person Pacifica National Board meetings from 4 to 3 and would continue the practice of alternating the board meetings among the 5 Foundation radio station signal areas. This amendment will be voted on at the January 26th through 28th, 2007 PNB meeting in Houston, Texas, and by each of the 5 network stations' local station board delegate assemblies. It must pass by majority vote at 3 of the 5 stations. For the full text of this bylaws amendment, log on to pacifica.org or call 510-849-2590, extension 207, to request a copy by mail. KPFT Houston.
KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. This is the World Village Cafe. Hello, Houston. I'm your host, Tony K, and welcome to another packed and eventful edition of the World Village Cafe. In case you're new to the station KPFT and this is your first time listening to us, well, this show comes to you every Monday night at 10 p.m. and aims at bringing you the issues that affect the many international communities living in Houston and the entire USA. Well, it has already been a week since we were last on air, and on that note, I would like to thank those who are tuning in through the airwaves in Houston and our surrounding cities, as well as those who are listening worldwide through the internet on www.kpft.org. As far as the festivities tonight, of course, we have a packed and eventful...
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.